Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alan Chartok, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to WAMC's Linda Norris Auditorium. I want to thank all of you for pledging during the past fund drive. We love each and every one of you. From fighting attorney general to former governor and currently nightly host of Viewpoint on Current TV, Elliot Spitzer is one of the smartest and nicest, I want to tell you, people I know. We are incredibly grateful that he agreed to spend some time with us this afternoon. And with the elections right around the corner, I think today's conversation is going to be the hottest ticket in town. We've provided index cards for your questions for Governor Spitzer. We'll get to as many of them as we can. Please join me in welcoming back to Albany my friend, Elliot Spitzer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
That was great. Governor Spitzer, if I can call you Elliot, I will. And I appreciate that. We're in the throes of a very close election. And I wondered if you would be kind enough to take out your crystal ball and tell us what's at work here.
Well, first I'll make a prediction. And it's one that I think is something I hope that occurs as well as that I think will occur, which is that President Obama will be reelected. It is, as you just said, much closer than one would have predicted even as recently as 3 weeks ago. The factors that have tightened this race up, from the obvious, the first debate, to the deeper anxiety in the public that manifests itself as you get closer and closer to an election, are easy to diagnose. Having said all that, Ohio, when you play the Electoral College game, Ohio, Pennsylvania, even I think Virginia at the end of the day will be in the president's column, and so we will be comfortable on election night that he will break the 270 barrier. Parenthetically, well, interesting constitutional footnote, if it's a 269-269 tie, then bizarre things will happen. It goes to the House where each state gets one vote. Mitt Romney would be elected president and Joe Biden would be elected vice president by the Senate. So not that anybody wishes this on the country, but that would be a fascinating cabinet meeting. It would be. But the reason it's close is that Mitt Romney, and I don't want to be critical of him as an individual, I think he's a compassionate person. I think he's smart. I think he was an effective businessman. Whatever we may think about what Bain did and its leverage and how it ran itself as a private equity firm. But he is giving the public vapors, amorphous ideas without any specifics. But we know that at times of anxiety, that type of politics works. His tax plan doesn't add up. His foreign policy is bellicose language without any substance and any fundamental distinctions between what he says and what the president has done quite effectively. He is preying upon the emotions of the hard right and then veering back to the middle in a way that the media has permitted him to get away with. There's some parts of the media, unfortunately, and I don't want to blame the media, but I think there has been a staggering lack of explanation to any of the inherent contradictions in his policies. And the president, on the other hand, the first debate was not a great show, shall we admit them. Having said that, he also has not explained with sufficient specificity what the second term would be like. I think the one line in Paul Ryan's convention speech that resonated even with those of us who are firm advocates of the president is, do you want another 4 years like the past 4 years? And the president has not explained sufficiently why they will be different. And he's going to win. He is extremely smart. He's been a great president in many respects, even though we differ with him in many ways. Nonetheless, he will be reelected.
How do we differ with him in many ways?
Well, look, let me start with the one that's easiest for me to talk about because it flows most directly from what I did as AG, perhaps, or what people think I did as AG, which is the way we have failed to restructure the financial services sector. And I think that there was an inherent desire to rebuild the status quo, which has put us in a position where down the road we will encounter the same structural problems we've had in the past, rather than acknowledging whether it's too big to fail, socializing risk, privatizing game. There are many different ways to come at it, but the willingness to write a blank check to the financial services sector without demanding that they either confront the mortgage crisis in a way that would have permitted the economy to come back and shared, would have had a more generic broadening of the burden of what we went through, or the obligation to change the leadership of most of the financial services companies that brought us over the precipice, I think was disconcerting. Dodd-Frank is an adequate approach to this, but only adequate, and to the extent that there are provisions in there that were structural in nature, they emanated not from the White House, but from either Capitol Hill or the advocacy groups on the outside. And I think Dick Durbin, a wonderful senator, who early on when there was, I mean, not to get too granular about this, but there was a vote in the Senate that would have permitted judges to reform mortgages in the context of bankruptcy, and that vote lost, and the White House was on the wrong side. It was Dick Durbin who said, do the banks really own this place? And the answer, unfortunately, back then was yes. And so I'm not saying this is that people are bad, crooked, whatever. It was still the ethos of maintaining the status quo. So in terms of differences, that is one. I think there are certain civil liberties issues where I've been troubled and surprised a little bit. I think that when it came to towards the end in June of this year was a great year, both in terms of the president's advocacy in terms of immigration issues, same-sex issues. Suddenly there was a crystallization. I don't think there was any correlation between that and the election in November. One would be cynical to think such a thing, but the president certainly moved forward in important ways, and I think actually to a certain extent his reelection will hinge upon that. That was the moment when the base that was so excited 4 years ago stood up and said, yes, this is the president we voted for. And so I think those were important steps forward. Not closing Guantanamo was problematic. I think that the negotiations with the Republicans over the past couple of years showed a sort of a temerity that was troubling sometimes. And frankly, I think the reason the first debate was so problematic was that people saw in him that night a lack of fortitude that perhaps said to them, maybe this is why the negotiations didn't go so well. As this is not my line. Afterwards, people are saying, if he's not going to defend himself, is he going to defend us? And so fortunately, second debate was a completely different persona. That was the Barack Obama we love. But so there have been policy differences. I think we are finally getting out of Afghanistan, but 4 years too late. And it is hard these days. And I don't say this, again, critically, as though any one of us can pretend to have been the font of all wisdom at any moment in time. But I think the arc of our learning about that region of the world has been unfortunately slow. And you can now add us to the list of empires that have sunk our teeth into something that was simply undigestible.
What about the rest of foreign policy? Apparently, Americans are, according to the latest polling, are beginning to wonder about President Obama's handling of foreign policy. I like what I see, but I'm just fascinated by the fact that people are losing faith. What is that?
Well, let's separate the substance from the moment, the visuals of the moment. The visuals of the moment are Benghazi and Syria. And we all have short-term memory that overrides the longer-term perspective. What happened in Benghazi is a tragedy. It's a mess. It's not a conspiracy. It's not a cover-up. It's not all the things that the far right is trying to turn it into. But it is right now the topic of conversation. And to that extent, it is deeply troubling. Syria is, I think, a point where people can fairly disagree with the lack of a plan that has emanated from the White House. Now, there is no good answer there, and I've spoken to many, many people, both on my show and off, trying to say, what should we do, what could we do? Intervention of some form, more aggressive than has been shown by the United States thus far, probably would have been wise, a no-fly zone, given humanitarian aid. There are things we could have done along the way, not fundamental shifts, we're not going to send the Marines in, but to answer your question, if Syria and Benghazi right now are the visuals that dominate our foreign policy conversation, you can understand why people are saying are sensing a bit of discomfort. The debate tomorrow night will be interesting in that regard. Put that aside. I agree with you. The foreign policy writ large has been sensible. It has been sound. I think he navigated the Arab Spring very well. He threaded the needle between, think of it this way, the contract we had, whether you liked the contract or not, the contract we had with the autocrats in North Africa and the Middle East ran out. Their time has passed. They were going. The question was, how do you navigate a transition to what will hopefully be a secular democratic series of regimes in that region of the world? Anybody who has studied revolutions, social transitions, knows it is going to be a difficult period. These things don't happen overnight. They didn't happen overnight here. And it was a much easier process for us 200 plus years ago. So it has been bumpy. Whether Libya or Egypt will end up more like Turkey or Pakistan or Iran remains to be seen, right? And you have a spectrum there of theocracy, democracy, tolerance that runs the gamut. It is not easy to know or predict, but we are trying to navigate what is a very difficult dynamic. Now, the relationship with Israel, which gets a great deal of attention from Mitt Romney, I to this day do not understand a lot of the rhetoric saying we are not close enough to Israel. This president has been a devout supporter, as we should be, of Israel. He has disagreed with Israel, as he should have at some points, about settlements, about negotiations. Being a friend doesn't always mean saying yes, right? And that's a simple reality of life, and it's about time that people woke up to that fact. When it comes to the security of Israel, nobody has been better. No nation will be better than we, but that doesn't mean you have to always agree about settlement policies, and we won't. So I remember the speech that was sort of the edge, the cutting edge, when he gave a speech about the Middle East where he talked about the fact that there would be renegotiated lines with the consent of the Israelis, and everybody got bent out of shape. It was like, what are you talking about? This is what Israeli prime ministers have said. This is what every president has said. So I don't understand that rhetoric. The issue that we really have to confront long term is economic policy from an international perspective, and there we have a tough battle.
How come we've heard so much about the 1% and the 99%? How come this is a close election?
Well, I wish I could answer that. I don't know. I mean, that was, the great book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which tried to explain why people vote in ways that appear, to us at least, to be contrary to their interest. And the reason I say appear is because I'm always hesitant to speak for somebody else and say you're voting against your interest. Like the question that is objectionable in a courtroom, when they ask me what you're thinking, how do I know? So it's hard, but it is hard to get your arms around the fact that social policy put in place, policies plural, put in place by predominantly Republican administrations over the past number of years have appeared to redistribute wealth and opportunity and the social goods that we care about in a way that is contrary to both equity and economic growth. Now, we're not using charts today, but I'm not going to give you your last name because it may cause you harm in Albany, but a very good friend of mine who's sitting in the front row knows I love numbers, and one of my favorite charts these days is the chart that shows productivity since from 1950 to the present going up in a continuous line, but wages going up parallel to that line, they're collinear until about 1975, and then the wages flatten out. Sure. That chart is the most important chart in terms of understanding income distribution in America. Since about 1975, even though we have continued to be incredibly productive and our workers are more productive than any workers in the world, the benefits of that productivity have gone to the owners of capital, not to workers. This is not in dispute. The question is why. Many of us would believe it's because of the social policies put in place by the Republicans, but it is also, it's globalization, it's technology. We have 2 billion additional workers in the world who are now compressing wages. And so how you confront that is the tough issue, but people continue to vote for the policies that favor the 1% rather than working folks.
Don't you think it's that the middle class aspire, identify with the 1%, even though they have no reason to do that?
Well, I would agree with everything until the last words. I'm not so sure I agree that they have no reason to. I mean, there is still social mobility.
Somebody's got to win the lottery.
Somebody's got to win the lottery. That's true. So buy your lotto ticket. No, it's a reality that social mobility is much diminished today compared to where it was 30, 40 years ago. And it's diminished. That's within the United States. And it's diminished in the United States. There's less mobility here than in many other industrialized nations. And many people would say that's because of the policies we've put in place that have created a rigidity. Great book that just came out by Krista Freeland called The Plutocrats, which is, it's a good read, and it talks about how the 1% is not only a 1% here in the United States, obviously, but there's a global, plutocracy has a negative sound to it, and I think intentionally so, there's a global elite that is more comfortable with itself than the 1% in any one nation is with the other 99% in that nation. So I think, are we seeing a stratification across the world as this battle, as it were, between capital and labor continues to evolve. As I said, those two lines used to be collinear. Workers used to get the upside of their increased productivity. It's not happening as much, and how you overcome that is really the big problem.
Are you surprised by that?
No, I mean, because this, as I say, I mean, look, Thomas Friedman, his brilliant writer, whose most brilliant moment perhaps was the metaphor of the world is flat, right? I mean, that is a reality. You can't undo the laws of technology or the laws of economics or the reality of technology. And Apple, you know, I don't know how many of us in this room, actually, I'm still a BlackBerry person, I hate to admit it, but anybody who has an Apple, Apple is the perfect metaphor for this in the sense that the 1% who design, who do the technology work here in Silicon Valley for Apple have done very, very well. But the job of making the actual product in Foxconn over in China is, you know, the reason that so many jobs that used to be here are no longer here. And in another interesting article by Times reporter Catherine Rampell that talked about what jobs have been created since the crash. We lost jobs in the mid-wage scale area, but the jobs that are being created are at the bottom of the wage scale. Now, there's a job. All jobs are not equal, right? It's better to have a job than no job, but all jobs are not equal. And to the extent that the jobs that we are creating are at low wages, or at a few at the very, very top, but not in the middle, then we have, again, a long-term problem because we are seeing hollowing out not only of our employee, of the middle class, but also the opportunity for social mobility.
You were the sheriff of Wall Street. You addressed this a little bit, but I just want to ask you, are the bad guys winning? This is a sophisticated question.
Yes. I mean, at one level, yes. At a broad level, I hate to sort of talk about this in terms of bad guys, good guys. Let me be a bit more subtle than perhaps I always was. subtlety is no fun. But there were many phenomena that occurred on Wall Street. Right? One of them was a mass hysteria, a susceptibility to bubbles and a susceptibility to the idea of this time we've really solved the problem. And, you know, Alan Greenspan, who was, in my view, really a disaster as the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank because of what he did for many, many years, wasn't a bad guy, wasn't a malicious guy. He thought he was doing the right thing. So he's not a bad guy. He was just wrong. I mean, trust me, there are many, many things worse than being wrong. But his policies were wrong. And in retrospect, we can appreciate that. So there were many people, many bankers, many people on Wall Street who were just wrong, and they fell and lapsed into this notion that you could securitize all this debt, you could market all of this subprime stuff, and somehow it would all work out. All right? There were some who committed fraud, who knew that the stuff was bad. You know, I think that's why I think Eric Schneiderman's most recent case against Morgan Chase is important. It is based to a great extent upon documents from Clayton Holdings, which is a due diligence company. Some of us who had seen these documents a bit earlier, Eric had seen them, but made the case, obviously. They're highlighted in the FCIC report by Phil Angelides. These documents are the Rosetta Stone if you want to understand what was really going on out there, because they show you that certain banks and certain bankers knew that what was going on was deeply, deeply problematic and continued to market the stuff. So those people who knew that things were bad and ugly, to a great extent, are getting away with it. And that is troubling to me. I think it doesn't, you know, you asked earlier about areas where I was, you know, differed a little bit from the Obama administration. The Justice Department's handling of that has, you know, not been its bright spot. I'll leave it at that. I mean, the failure to bring additional cases, civil or criminal. Criminal cases are hard. When I was AG, we tried to bring criminal cases. We brought some. Not all succeeded. But civil cases, based upon the evidence that is out there, should have been brought in greater number against institutions and individuals for what happened. The public deserves to have some sense of justice having been served. And I think, as your question took as its premise, that sense has not been not satisfied. It's not as though there's a bloodthirst and therefore you feed it, but there is a sense that, wait a minute, we gave the banks all the money, they didn't restructure, nobody's paid the penalty, and partly as a consequence, we are rebuilding the same edifice, and it will happen once again. And interestingly, if there was a conceptual error 15, 20 years ago, it was the notion that we wanted big all-service banks all under one roof. Sandy Weill created it, Citibank, and he believed it would work. Some of us, you know, many who have studied it much more deeply than I and many more sophisticated than I said, no, it won't work. And the reason I didn't think it would work is because they're too big to manage. There are conflicts of interest inherent in those banking structures that lead to problems. At the end of the day, even Sandy Weill now acknowledges the model doesn't work. And if Sandy Weill and Dan Tarullo at the Federal Reserve, and I would say at least 30 to 40% of the bankers whom I speak with agree that this is a bad idea, maybe it's time now to take apart that model, because it's still, the big banks are bigger now than they used to be.
The Republicans, at least in the House, seem to be committed to reversing Dodd-Frank and to going back the other way. Is this outrageous to you?
Well, you know, it's a bizarre thing that they are. I've given up trying to figure out exactly what intellectual foundation there is to some of these positions, because at the end of the day, you just say, okay, not worth the anxiety. Yeah, you're right. They make this sort of reflexive noise. If the president signed it, we have to repeal it. And then when you say to them, okay, what do you want instead? Even Mitt Romney, bizarrely, now part of this was political jujitsu, but at the first debate, he came at Dodd-Frank from the left. Right? I mean, it was bizarre when he said Dodd-Frank is the biggest embrace of the big banks, as though he was going to be the one who would take over and be critical and make life harder for the big banks. He understood that this was part of a political repositioning. But it is part of one strand of the Republican Party, which is a populist anti-Wall Street strand. Right? I mean, the Tea Party, again, I've given up trying to make sense out of it. And anybody who carries a sign, "Get government out of my Medicare," you know, you got to say, you know. God, you know, you give up. But there is a piece of them that says they don't like the big banks. And some of the senators back when I was in office and I'd talk to some of their conservative Republican senators, they were skeptical of the power of the big banks and as a consequence wanted to rein them in. Now, where they would go if they had carte blanche, who knows? Mitt Romney, again, he's a smart guy. He understands finance. He understands both the upside and the downside of the banking structure. I think he understands too big to fail is still a problem.
George McGovern just passed. Yep. He got swamped when he ran against Nixon. And in the background were the dark music of Watergate and all the rest of it. What was that sort of strand in the American people that just distrusted that brand of progressivism that he represented?
Look, short answer is I don't know. I was 13 in 1972. And I do remember, you know, my earliest political sort of consciousness, I think, was 1968 when Nixon was elected. And I remember the outcome wasn't determined until the next morning. I got up and turned on the sort of black and white TV we had. And I remember saying to myself, we can't really elect Richard Nixon. Somehow, something struck me as wrong with that notion, even when I was, eight or 9 years old. George McGovern was a great man. He was a man of conscience. He was a man of great insight. Democracy isn't perfect. You know, it's like every system, like the jury system. The jury system makes mistakes. Democracy makes mistakes. It doesn't mean it isn't the best system ever created to solve the issue of how you pick leaders or render judgment in civil or criminal cases, but we make mistakes. George McGovern played to an imagery of the Democratic Party at the moment, and again, this is recollection way back, that lost, sort of laid the foundation for Reagan Democrats, right? There was a lack of toughness that many attributed to him. There was a lack of certitude about the way he spoke about foreign affairs. Look at the way we still like to talk about exceptionalism. There are certain things we like to think about ourselves as a nation that he did not touch those buttons and push those buttons adequately. Instead, he came across, unfortunately, as being softer, more subtle, more nuanced, which doesn't always work. He was a stupendous man. I only met him once or twice as the years went by. And, you know, one of my early political memories is my dad was a huge supporter of his. Huge, huge supporter of his, and just thought that he was somebody who captured the ethics and the appropriateness and the values of what politics were supposed to be. So we've lost, you know, his politics changed over time. I remember reading some things that he wrote that were a little surprising as he got on years, but that happens, I suppose, to all of us.
You know what?
Maybe I don't know.
What a coward! What a coward he was. He only did 30 missions into Nazi Germany.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's unbelievable.
Right. It's the same sort of John Kerry. Yeah. You know, this stuff where John Kerry ended up playing defense in his presidential race about his war efforts. You know, it's crazy the way some of this can get turned around.
Here's a question. I didn't ask it. It comes from the audience, so I want to be careful that you don't hold it against me. What would you be doing differently if you were still governor today?
I wouldn't be here. No. That's not true. I'd be right here. Let me before I have to think up a creative answer for this one. So let me reiterate what Alan said at the very top, which is to thank all of you for supporting WAMC since I took that. It really is a joy to be here, to be part of this. And as Alan knows, I'm a huge fan of AMC and you, Alan.
You are. But before we go back to the question, yeah. I want to ask.
Come on. I was hoping we ignore the question.
Before we go back to the question, let me ask you this. I know that you have always had an interesting perspective on the funding of public broadcasting. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
I have, and this, I hope I don't get anybody in here upset. I would not be, for all reasons that completely differ, I'm sure, than Mitt Romney's, I would not be dissatisfied if public radio needed to be fully supported by the public. And here's why. And as Alan knows, I'm a contributor, and my family, we're contributors to AMC.
I'm not saying this to
shift responsibility. I always worry a little bit when government supports anything that transmits news and states political perspectives. It is an uncomfortable intersection between government and the First Amendment. And I prefer greater clarity in the distribution, in the separation of the two. And this isn't because, I love Big Bird, I really do. But this isn't about Big Bird.
So does Mitt,
that's right, even he says it. This is about preserving the integrity of AMC and NPR. And I think without any tremendous amount of effort, we could support them from the public writ large, get rid of the overhang and concern of government funding, which then limits and cabins what one can do in terms of the integrity of the political commentary. And I think there'd be greater integrity to it. Let me rephrase that. There'd be greater freedom. There's great integrity to it right now, but there'd be greater freedom that would result from not having the public, the government support.
An interesting perspective. There isn't a day that goes by, as Rob declined in the polls, that I haven't gotten email after email that suggests that people are pulling their punches because they think he's going to win. So even the perception can be very dangerous.
Right, but you can get rid of that set of concerns when you just say, we don't take government money, which, again, it would be hard. And as I understand, it would be harder for the TV component than for the radio component. But the notion of somehow keeping government money away from broadcast is not something I'm troubled by.
You want to go back to the other question?
Not really.
Okay. Well, we don't have to.
What I would do different than the current governor?
Yeah.
Let me say this. Andrew has a tough job. Obviously, I've disagreed with him on some things. I've supported him in some things. I think there are some real accomplishments. Getting same-sex marriage passed was wonderful. It was something that I think was going to happen inevitably because of the changing demographics and changing cultural values of our public, but it happened, and that's good. And credit goes far around. He's the governor. He got it done. He deserves it. Just to pick one area where I fundamentally disagreed, I think on redistricting, when it comes to the issues of maintaining the core of democracy, the deals that were cut, and they were cut way, way back on this, were troubling and too bad, but look, such is the nature of life. But I think what we need to focus on long term, and I'm sure the governor is, and I'm sure the legislature is, and this is what I was trying to do when I was in office, rebuilding our SUNY system, rebuilding higher ed, rebuilding the infrastructure of the state. New York State will succeed when it continues to be what it has historically been, which is the epicenter of intellectual capital. That is what drives our economy. We do not want to be, and have not been for over 100 years, a low-wage labor state. We are a state that has a wonderful, diverse economy. Yes, we do have enormous agricultural sector that I'm now proud part of. It's not that somebody sent me out to pasture, but it's that. but the diversity is there, but at its root, what drives us is the intellectual capital of the people in the state. That is a result of both a public and a private sector higher educational system that needs to be supported, needs to be invested in, and K-12. And so there are many things that are difficult we need to really focus on.
Here's a question for you. In retrospect, are you glad that you were able to be governor for a short time, or did the negative press completely ruin the experience?
I've seen many sides of the media, the short answer is I'm absolutely thrilled to have served the period of time that I did. We accomplished some things that I look back at with some pleasure. The team that we assembled was superb. They continued, many of them continued to serve for many years. Many of them are still there. What we did, just to give you one example in terms of education finance, where the CFE litigation that had gone on for many, many years was resolved in the first budget, and we were able to focus dollars in our educational system based increasingly upon need and the obligation to fund education fully rather than purely the political sway and need to allocate based upon political power. Any budgeting process has a big political component to it. And so anybody who's watched it, been part of it, no matter how you try to separate the politics out and do what you think is purely correct as a matter of policy, you know you can't be pure in that regard. Legislators are political. That's where they're designed to be. That's what they are. But I think we made genuine progress in that regard. I think we made real progress in terms of the healthcare finance issues, which are troubling. I mean, we have real problems in terms of controlling healthcare expenditures over the next 50 years. We need to be real about that. And if we're not real about that, then we will not have the funding to support education. And it's not that these are binary choices, education or healthcare, but to a great extent, a budget is a choice among many options. We have to be serious about that. And we tried to take a hard look at that and begin a restructuring. And so we did all sorts of things that give me some pleasure as I look back.
You tried very hard to elect a Democratic state Senate. The present governor, it seems to me, has not done that. In fact, quite the reverse. I wonder what conclusions you draw from that.
Well, look, I've seen headlines to the effect of what you just said. I won't draw my own conclusions, or at least I won't articulate my own conclusions right now. Let me say this, and let me put this into a little bit of perspective.
Sure.
Because I didn't, when I came to Albany as governor as opposed to attorney general, I didn't come to Albany and sit down with Joe Bruno and say, Joe, I want to elect a Democratic Senate. Because I don't like you. I like Joe. I mean, whatever all the record is. I said to him, I want to work with a Senate that will make determinations based upon good policy for the state. I'm not here as a partisan Democrat or a partisan Republican. I'm here, yes, I'm a Democrat, but I'm here to bring a set of values to how we govern. Show me that we can work together on education finance, on healthcare finance, on how we rebuild and decide and address the very, very tough issues that need to be addressed. And I thought over time it became pretty clear to me that electing a Democratic Senate would permit us on issues such as redistricting, which is not, redistricting is not a matter of D's versus R's, it's a matter of votes counting as they're supposed to be counted in a democratic process. And it should not be a mechanism whereby a distinct minority can retain control contrary to the dictates of democracy. And over time, I began to feel that we did need certainly greater equilibrium in the Senate. And I campaigned for a number of candidates whom I thought would be good additions to that body. We got there after I was gone as governor, but we'll see. I think at the end of the day, Andrew is going to have to navigate between what I hear is that the Republicans are likely to maintain control of the Senate post November 6. I hate to predict, all of these things, but if that's the case, he's going to have some tough issues. I'll give you one: minimum wage increase. There's absolutely no question in my mind we should be raising the minimum wage in the state of New York. I know there's some people who say it will cost jobs. The history, the economic history, when you look at it, is that we raise the minimum wage, it benefits society. This is something that I believe very deeply. And I think we have lost our way in that. We've done many things to benefit those who are better off. I think it's time we raised a minimum wage. That's merely one example of something that could be done with a different Senate.
Well, now the word on the street is that he's going to trade them a pay raise for an increase in minimum wages. Is that something that makes you want to hold your nose?
Well, let me say this. A governor doesn't have that many There are always cards to play, and negotiations to be had. You know, this is, and I don't want to wax too philosophical, but Lyndon Johnson did all sorts of trades and got us a Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson did all sorts of trades and got us a Voting Rights Act. Trades can be viewed through the purity of an editorial page, where yes, you do want to hold your nose, or it can be viewed through the more pragmatic world of how do we get good things done. And so, yes, you might want to do it and hold your nose at the same time. A governor has every year a budget, which has all sorts of stuff in it that legislators want, and you use that to negotiate. You have redistricting, and you have a pay raise. Those are sort of three of the big levers you've got to negotiate with the legislature. If he's going to give a pay raise to the legislature in return for a minimum wage increase, I would suggest that they be commensurate in size.
Here's a good question. Will you run for office again?
I have been elected dog walker in my own house. So this is, I thank you for the question to suggest it as possibilities. I love what I'm doing now. As Alan and I were talking a bit before the interview, I'm involved in a family business, which keeps me busy for a fair bit of the day. I have the TV show, and so I think I'm gainfully employed. I try to contribute through the media. The appeal of public office is real to anybody who's ever been there. Of course it's real. You like to think that you can contribute. Is it something I'm thinking about when I wake up in the morning? No. There are a lot of awfully good candidates out there. I'm beyond the stage where I think that I'm the only one who can do A, B, or C. There are a lot of folks who are talented, who are good, whom I support, and I think that we're being ably led, and there'll be able candidates.
Here's a wacko question. You went to the Horace Mann School. There's some stuff on the front pages of the newspapers now about some inappropriate behavior that was going on at the school there. What do you have to say about that?
You asked the question in a way that was properly oblique, so not everybody would understand.
Oh, yeah. Well, you better tell them.
So I won't hesitate to. Horace Mann, there have been allegations raised. There's a very powerful article in the New York Times Magazine section, probably about 6 months ago now. I can remember. It came out in June. It came out just the Sunday before graduation, because my eldest daughter graduated from Horace Mann this past year. And the article recounted, with what is presumed to be, and I believe to be accurate reporting, reports of sexual abuse of kids during the 1970s. In fact, when I was there. And I knew the teachers who were involved. And while I haven't spoken publicly about it yet, let me say this. I believe the allegations to be true. I believe that the issues have disappeared from the school and that this is a historical issue. I imagine, as with many institutions, it continued for a number of years beyond what was reported in that article. The leadership of the school at that time, which is the mid-1970s, not only did not deal with it properly, but perhaps was involved in a way that was not proper. And let me leave it at that. The school recently, under new leadership that I absolutely am supportive of, a new board that I'm absolutely supportive of, a head of school who is spectacular, has tried to do everything right to both remedy the problem, is figuring out how to make recompense to those who were injured. Like many institutions, back in the past, and I hope it is in the past, and I believe it's in the past, and obviously if new facts emerged, I would change my mind. It is trying to figure out, how do you maintain what is a superb school? I have deep loyalty to a place where I believe I got a great education. But also, you have to be fair to the history. Covering it up does not only no good, but does affirmative harm to those who are the individual victims and to the institution. So you balance all of this, and I hope that you emerge stronger as we go forward. But it is a story. Look, Horace Mann was clearly not Penn State, where the current leadership was involved. It was, you know, the stuff that's coming out now by the Boy Scouts, and I don't want to pass judgment. I haven't seen enough and don't know enough. I think they're handling it properly, and I hope so.
I have to tell you, you're a friend of mine, a friend of the station. You are a man of tremendous courage. For many of us who, you know, face things in our lives that maybe we don't like that much. You know, there are some people who run away. You've really shown an approach to to coming back in a lot of different senses. What advice would you have for all of us who've ever faced a difficult situation like this?
I don't know. I mean, I honestly say I don't know for two reasons. One, I really don't know, which is a good reason. And two, even if I did, I'm not sure that I am the right person to give guidance on these things. And I don't say that out of any false sense of humility. I think every person who's gone through some sort of personal difficult moment, many people have the benefit of going through it in private. You know, somebody who's very smart came up to me afterwards and said, you know, many people in life have a moment that is very difficult. You have the unfortunate reality of going through it in a somewhat public context. And I said, yes, somewhat understates it. But, you know, you try to learn from it. You try to go forward. You try to figure out what matters. And I guess I just leave it at that. It isn't easy. And I'm not going to pretend it is easy. So
you had the advantage of tremendous support from a wonderful family.
Yep.
Do you think that... Scale?
Absolutely. And it sounds trite, but obviously, you know, Alan knows I just drove over from, we were in Boston this morning, Sol and I, we were visiting two of our three daughters who are there, one just graduated from college, one who's in college. And, you know, that is obviously what is at the core of all of this. You spend your life trying to do something useful at a broader, deeper level. At the end of the day, it sounds like a Hallmark card, but it is your family that you come back to at the end of the day. And so that is deeply, deeply important.
Let's go from that to energy.
Energy, there you go. Easy transition.
Talk to us about fracking.
You know, this is a difficult area. I'm surrounded all day at Current by people who are deeply troubled by fracking and who believe at a sort of base level that you can't put stuff into the ground at that pressure, that much stuff, and have it come back up without there being very real environmental disasters that will result. And that is common sense. There is also a school of thought, and I've spoken to energy executives who say, if you do it right, it is safe. Doing it right is, of course, the out that they take. I'm skeptical right now. I just don't know how you can put that much stuff into the ground at that pressure and recycle it back up without damaging our aquifers, without doing fundamental harm. Is the opportunity to get natural gas from shale an extraordinarily tempting answer to the existing problems of dirty coal and nuclear? You bet. That is what hangs in the balance. I mean, when you deal with energy, we're dealing with a series of options. A few years ago, before the fracking explosion, maybe a bad metaphor too, for the fracking possibility was on as part of the conversation, nuclear power was gaining traction as an environmentally good answer. From a greenhouse gas perspective, it is appealing. Then we had Fukushima. Then we had the realization that we still haven't dealt seriously with the disposal issue. But it certainly appears better than dirty coal. Renewables, which are, of course, the right answer, renewables and efficiency. When I was governor, we put in, I think it was 15 by 15 or 20 by 20, 15 by 15. We're going to reduce our energy demand by 15% because of efficiency gains, and that is, it's doable. It's not only doable with continued economic growth. If you push efficiency and you use renewables, is where we need to go. Should we have a carbon tax? Unquestionably, yes. It is good policy. It is a conservative economic idea. It would push us away from carbon-based fuels towards all the right answers. Would Mitt Romney go for it? I doubt it, even though Glenn Hubbard, his economic advisor, has written favorably about it in the past. But this is not to distract from the tough issue of fracking. We need a redirection. The president is trying to do it. You know, I'm not totally thrilled. You asked earlier on about where he had been a little mushy. On some of his energy positions, he's been a bit mushy. But I suppose that's understandable.
Could you define mushy?
Wrong.
You knew a lot about the state government and the DEC, and you know they're going to need to, if we do the fracking, they'll need all kinds of inspectors and the rest. We certainly don't have them right now, and we certainly don't know all of the stuff that they're putting down there to this day and what their reactions will be. This is, as you indicate, kind of troubling.
Well, that's why, look, at a minimum, if we're going to have fracking, the federal government should step in a real way and should say, if it's going to be permitted anywhere, here's what you need to do in terms of disclosure, in terms of ensuring the casings don't fail, in terms of there not being leakage, in terms of the disposal of the stuff up top. This is an area where this having it regulated state by state simply doesn't work, and having it regulated county by county is even worse, because this problem does not respect county or state lines. Right, and when there's an environmental issue or disaster, it's going to percolate up and it's going to follow the aquifers, follow the stress lines, the fault lines. It's not going to follow state lines. And so we need a federal government that steps in and says, if we're going to have it, here is the threshold minimum that we need to require. The question you raise about not having an adequate number of inspectors, the antipathy towards government that pervades the sort of Republican ideology right now and the Tea Party, obviously, is highlighted by that sort of issue. If you're going to, we do things that require smart government. Smart government isn't big government, but it's smart government. And you know, I had this sort of crazy debate with Glenn Beck. It was don't ask why. It was, but it was kind of fun. But you hear sort of what passes for ideology on the other side, and he loves to quote Hamilton and Jefferson and the rest. And then you say, but wait a minute, Hamilton understood we needed a national bank, the equivalent of the Fed, to run our economy. Hamilton wanted a national infrastructure, such as the Erie Canal, the interstate highway system, and energy program, and yet they then lapse back into their anti-government rhetoric that is completely nonsensical. We need a government that can meaningfully regulate certain sectors where the absence of regulation creates great risk and harm. And that is, you're right, we need a smart DEC that can do these things and can do it appropriately.
I would just mention, and I don't want to hang you up too long on this, that we have a president who likes all these energy options, and you say mushy. It bothers me if you have a federal approach to it, which a president who may want it goes easy.
Well, here's part of there has been a lack of articulation on the part of the White House over the years about why government should and must do certain things. There's been a defensiveness about explaining what it's all for. And I understand that. Sometimes the response when you have all these incoming missiles and he had to deal with a recalcitrant, doesn't even state it, a very aggressive perspective on the other side that was hostile to whatever he was proposing. But if along the way he had explained affirmatively why we needed smart regulation of Wall Street, then maybe we could have had greater public support for Dodd-Frank. Why we needed a stimulus. Let's face it, the stimulus worked. You know, this is not some mythology that's being created by the crazy left. Keynesian economics is right. We've had this massive experiment. We tried Keynes here. They tried austerity in Europe. They're in double-dip recessions. They have 25% unemployment. We are not where we should be, but the economy is beginning to come back. If the White House had explained not only that these things work, but why, had explained that the history of the United States is not the Marlboro Man riding out on a horse by individually building everything west of the Mississippi with his two bare hands. No, it's the federal government with land grants, helping with the railroad, on and on, the Erie Canal, whatever metaphor you want. Explain what it is. That doesn't mean we want to waste taxpayer money. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. But if there had been a more assertive, what I call the second debate president, you know, over the course of the first three and a half years, I think we would be in a different place in terms of the public understanding.
Here's a question. What are your thoughts about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms? We have a lot of slaughter in the streets right now.
Look, this is one of those unfortunate moments where the Second Amendment, look, first, we have it. The right to bear arms, in my view, was never meant to mean individuals could carry a gun wherever, whenever, however. The regulation of the sale and ownership of guns is something that was rightfully understood to be constitutional until extremely recently. The current Supreme Court has given a greater latitude to the Second Amendment than I think is historically appropriate or correct, and I'm deeply troubled by it. I've been a firm advocate of appropriate gun control for, you know, as long as I can remember. Now, look, it's a funny thing. Back in 1994, when I ran unsuccessfully for Attorney General, I ran an ad talking about how we could actually number bullets, and therefore this would be a way of tracing it back to ownership and sale, so we could actually solve crimes. people said, oh, that's not technologically possible. It was back then. It was more expensive. Then now we have it with micro printing, and it's become kind of commonly accepted that we can and should do it as a way of solving crimes. It's the equivalent of DNA in the ordinary criminal context. There are all sorts of things we can do. We should reinstate a ban on the sale of AK-47s and semi-assault weapons. There's no reason, I mean, this is... There's no reason you need magazines that sell 100 bullets. That's not for hunting. It's not the. There's a very powerful ad that was done. We then had pulling a blank on his name. Wonderful kid, graduated from Syracuse, SU, last June, won a Fulbright, was on a cross country bike tour, and ended up in Aurora in the movie theater, and was one of the victims of that horrific shooting. Has survived. Is now deferred his Fulbright, and is now spending a year on gun control. And I'm embarrassed I forgot his name, but an amazing kid, articulate, smart, everything you'd want to see in the next generation. And you look at him and you say, and others created a TV ad that aired during the presidential debates, basically saying to the candidates, please, talk about gun control. Give us your views. Both, you ask where I differ with the president, they both ran away from it. They both ran away. And I know the politics of this. It's not easy. But I almost would have preferred to see them look into the camera and say, yep, I'm afraid of the NRA. Sorry. Full stop. That's what it is. You know, the NRA is simply wrong at every level. Meaningful gun control is a smart thing.
Here's a question, but it doesn't have a question mark. It says, hopefully you will be our president someday.
All right. Now, well, thank you very much. Whoever wrote it. That's not my handwriting, just so don't worry.
You did mention the SC word, the Supreme Court. Whatever differences you may have with this president, obviously this is a tremendous incentive to get people
Absolutely.
Based on Citizens United, you know, and the kinds of things you're talking about to, mm-hmm. to vote for the Democratic ticket.
Look, I think his nomination...
That's a question.
No, it's a statement with which I fully agree, so I'll pretend it's a question. His nominees to the Supreme Court have been spectacular. Justices Sotomayor and Kagan are smart, thoughtful. And I don't say this. Diversity on the Supreme Court is a good thing. When you're making a Supreme Court selection, you're looking for a demeanor. You're looking for a perspective. I think they have been absolutely stellar justices in both their questioning, their even-handedness, their full disclosure, Elena, has been a friend since freshman year in college. I know her extremely well, and she is spectacularly smart and is just the sort of intellect you would want in the Supreme Court. Now, having said that, Justice Scalia is also an amazing intellect. He just happens to be wrong. but I think when you get to, and what I'm looking forward to actually, and maybe I shouldn't even say this, what I'm looking forward to is 30 or 40 years from now, somebody who writes the memoir to explain how Justices Breyer and Kagan, and I call her Justice Kagan in this with full deference, voted with Chief Justice Roberts on the Medicaid piece of the Health Care Act. If it was a trade to make sure that we got the fifth vote so he would come over and say it's constitutional as a matter of the tax, under the tax clause, that's the sort of trade that you hold your nose and you do, as other trades we discussed earlier, because obviously maintaining the constitutionality of that statute was important. I think any first-year law student would read our Commerce Clause jurisprudence, however, to see that it was constitutional under the Commerce Clause jurisprudence as well. And so rewriting Commerce Clause jurisprudence the way he did could long-term be a little bit harmful, but maintaining the constitutionality of the statute was important. Important as a matter of constitutional principles, important as a matter of healthcare policy. Also, and this is not, I imagine, how he thought about it, important politically, because had the president lost that, I think he would have been playing defense from now until election day, and they would have been able to say a president who accomplished very little. Not true, but that would have been the imagery.
And how dangerous is Citizens United?
Okay, I'm going to say something that will shock you. I think they got it right. And I know nobody in this room agrees with me. And here's why. This comes back to the First Amendment. I think the danger is if we could revisit the issue of corporations as people, that would be great. But as a First Amendment matter, the entity that was airing the ridiculous and venomous, awful video that was at the heart of this factually in my view, had the right to air that as much as it wanted, as often as it wanted. It was core First Amendment speech. The ACLU agrees with me. Floyd Abrams argued the case for them. Floyd is, I think many folks appreciate, is one of the great First Amendment lawyers. The danger that I see is in ever limiting speech. You don't beat bad speech by quieting it. You beat bad speech by having a more persuasive argument that you make as often as you can. The answer to Citizens United is disclosure. The crime and the difficulty and the problem I have with our finance, many problems with the finance system we have with campaigns right now, one of them is the lack of transparency, the fact that these super PACs are hidden. That could be remedied and should be remedied legislatively. That imposition of an obligation to disclose would be fully constitutional and is where we should go. But the idea that we silence people and say that you can't use your funds, your megaphone. Yesterday, we were riding out driving out from Boston to Sudbury, which is the farm where my eldest daughter's working, and so we went out to visit. And somebody on a bicycle had a placard saying, "Vote for Elizabeth Warren." That's free speech. Nobody should ever stop that person from doing it. If that person had a megaphone, nobody should stop him from doing it. If he wanted to print a video and mail it to everybody, nobody should stop that person from doing it. Free speech is so core and central. I'm hard-pressed, really, to think of when I would ever cabin that speech.
Skokie?
But that's different. That is, sometimes it's different, sometimes it's not. Look, fire in the crowded auditorium where there's an imminent danger to others is one thing. What is pure political speech, that where you simply are trying to equalize the strength of the speech, is not a justification for limiting it. As I say, I know not everybody agrees with me, but it's where I come down on this stuff.
Here's a question we haven't addressed before. What would you be doing differently if you were still governor today? I just came around to the other end. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You know, I think I would be, as I said, there's a legislative agenda, and then there is an administrative agenda. I think governors sometimes get too wrapped up in the legislative agenda because it's easy to be pulled into the back and forth of the legislative body, but there's really an enormous breadth of creativity that is permissible through the agencies, everything from DEC to the Department of Corrections to economic development. I think that is where I remember being very pleased with and proud of the commissioners we put in place. I'd be working much more with them to push an economic development agenda and legislatively minimum wage.
We have a huge unemployment number in New York State. Yep. What's that about?
Well, this is the hollowing out of the economy. We have, even in New York City, New York City is becoming a much more stratified city than it used to be. New York City has been maintained by financial services. New York City finance, insurance, real estate, which were driving New York City. Manufacturing left a fair number of years ago, but you had media, you had sort of high-end positions that kept the city going economically. Right now, 20% of New York City's population is in poverty. That is a staggering number. Now, part of that would be remedied by raising the minimum wage. Part of it would be putting more money into our educational system. Part of it is by finding the next industries that can locate in New York. And that's why I think Mike has done a very good job when he tries to get biotech and nanotech here in Albany. Has worked out well. I think we need biotech to come to New York City. We need the new VC companies that had been born in Silicon Valley that are now relocating to New York City to come to New York City. Upstate is still more difficult, but we have an agricultural sector that is doing a little bit better. Sometimes I hear, I haven't traveled as much, we have not done well to get our light manufacturing sector vibrant here in New York State, and that's something that can be done.
Well, we, of course, could talk for another 3 hours, but Elliot Spitzer has always been there for WAMC. Let's give him a great hand and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.